happy birthday today to Marjorie Froisland of Moreland, to Marlene Doctorman of Cedar Rapids, and to Beverly, whom folks call Bev, Beverly Divis of Sioux City. Happy birthday to all of you today. Hope you're having a good day. You're joined on your birthday by musician Larry Gatlin of the Gatlin Brothers. He turned 76 today. Journalist Mika Brzezinski is 57 today. And The Rock, Dwayne Johnson, turns 52 today. Happy birthday to one and all. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who's listening in order to keep our services free. Now we'll turn to Linda with our first obituary.
Ione Lucinda Hall of Des Moines passed away on April 27th. A visitation from 10 a.m. will be held at the True Bible Baptist Church on May 3rd. A funeral service will follow at 11 a.m. Interment will take place following the services at Glendale Cemetery. From Bondurant, Betty Lindman, 92, passed away April 19th. She was born December 13, 1931, in Jennings, Kansas. Betty is survived by her daughters, Donna Kelso Rausch and Carol Kelso, and granddaughter, Sean Kelso. Betty's wishes were to be cremated with no services. Condolences and to read the full obituary, you can visit hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. From Des Moines, we lost a man of music, art, philosophy, science, and untold threads of knowledge. My sister Barb once asked him, and this person I thought was going to be mentioned again, Joseph Dennis Hardy. So my sister Barb once asked him, "How do you know all this stuff, Joe?" "Well, I read a lot and sometimes make up stuff to fill in the blanks. Makes me smile thinking about it." He passed away last Thursday night at Mercy Hospital while waiting for a bed at Kavanaugh House. So like Joe to leave on his own terms. Jack was with him and Liz and I quickly returned to the hospital. Blurry, painful days, so you rely on what you know. I know that he deeply loved me, Jack, and Amanda, Liz, and Thomas, and especially his girls, Faye and Judy. He also loved this large, exuberant family, and it is this love that is giving us such comfort and strength right now. So grateful for all of you, family and friends. Joseph Dennis Hardy, May 7th, 1950, to April 25th, 2024. Joe was born in Des Moines to Miriam Firkins Hardy and Thomas E. Hardy. He is predeceased by his parents and an older brother, Thomas. Joe graduated from Roosevelt High School and Drake University with a fine arts degree, going on to study printmaking at Northern Illinois University. Always interested in technology, he earned a computer IT degree and worked as a networking specialist. He is survived by his wife, Lori Anderson of Des Moines, his son, Jack Hardy, daughter-in-law, Amanda Hardy, and granddaughter, Faye of Kansas City, daughter, Elizabeth Hardy, and son-in-law, Thomas Hardy, and granddaughter, Judith of Des Moines. His survivors also include a large and loving family of aunts, uncles, cousins, as well as dear friends. Joe will be cremated and his remains laid to rest at a family private service. A commemoration of his life will take place this summer, the date and place to be determined.
Marjorie Ann, known as Margie Katzman, 88, of Johnston, passed away April 25 in McAllen, Texas. Funeral services will be held at 11:30 a.m. Saturday on May 4th at Isles Westover Chapel on Hickman Road in Des Moines. Visitation will begin at 10:30 a.m. prior to the service. Interment for Margie and Jerry will be held at Lincoln Cemetery near Granger, Iowa. Margie was born May 17, 1935, in Des Moines, where she lived most of her life. She worked for the Des Moines Public Schools lunch program for many years and retired in 1999. On July 8, 1994, she was united in marriage to Gerald, known as Jerry Katzman, at Zion Lutheran Church in Des Moines, where they were active in the church choir. Margie and Jerry had a great love for music. They provided music and entertainment to local care centers, Iowa State Fair, and the Far South Jams in Far, Iowa. They also enjoyed fishing and spending winters in Far, Texas. Margie was a member of the Des Moines Women's Club, Des Moines Corvette Club, a Hall of Famer with the PMECI, the Professional Musician and Entertainers Club of Iowa, and the Far South Trio. Margie loved her family, and one of her favorite things was being Mooga to her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Margie is survived by her children, Jim, partner Siri Luck Baker, Joyce, partner Paul Binder, and Jeff, partner Becky Baker. Four grandchildren, Jessica and partner Dusta Stevens, Sarah and partner Jason DeLate, Ashley and partner Tristan Herringer, and Brett Baker. Numerous step-grandchildren and great-grandchildren, a nephew John, partner Debbie Marmon, and their families. She was preceded in death by her husband Jerry on December 25 of 2022. Her parents, Merle Red and Francis Steele, Scobie, her twin sister Margaret McConnell, and her brothers Jimmy and Kenny Scobie. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be directed to the Des Moines Women's Club Scholarship Program, the American Cancer Society, or Iowa Alzheimer's Association. Online condolences are welcome at the Isles Care Funeral Homes website. From Des Moines, Donald Blair Price, aged 85, passed away peacefully on Sunday, April 28, at Taylor House Hospice in Des Moines, surrounded by his family. Donald was born November 6 in Johnston, Pennsylvania, to Richard and Magdalene Price. One of four children, he grew up in Ebensburg, a small town in Pennsylvania, and lived next door to his grandparents, Alan and Annie. He worked summers on a paint crew for his father's business while he attended St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania, where he received his bachelor's degree. He went on to receive his master's degree from Penn State and his doctorate from Stanford. He started teaching at the Ohio State University, I believe that is. In 1967, Donald moved with his young family to Vermilion, South Dakota, and went on to become a tenured professor in the history department at the University of South Dakota. He lived in Vermilion for 56 years until moving to Ankeny, Iowa in December of 23 to be closer to family. Throughout the years, he cultivated many interests. He was an avid runner, bike rider, photographer, gardener, world traveler, and chef. He was a good and kind man who loved to learn and loved to teach. He enjoyed imparting his love of history and general knowledge, and the listener always left the conversation enriched. Donald was preceded in death by his wife, Regina. He is survived by his son, Christopher, and partner Kirsten Price of Minneapolis, daughter Lisa and partner Dan Burke of Des Moines, six grandchildren and eight grandchildren. A memorial visitation will be held from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Sunday, May 5th, at Hamilton's Funeral Home on Lyon Street in downtown Des Moines. In lieu of flowers, contributions may be would be appreciated by to the American Cancer Society, and condolences may be expressed on the Hamilton Funeral Home website. And we finished up the Metro and Iowa stories before we went to birthdays, so now we'll return to the front page section with Linda.
Faculty workers rally at Columbia's gates. Hundreds arrested at New York campus protests while UCLA cancels classes. Hundreds of faculty and graduate student workers rallied on a Sunday, sunny Wednesday afternoon outside Columbia University's only open entrance, protesting the university's decision to send police on campus and arrest more than 100 pro-Palestinian demonstrators the night before. Protesters held "No Cops on Campus" signs as police entered and exited the school's gates just feet away. Others held signs calling for university president Minoush Shafik to resign. Faculty members said they were barred from entry as the campus remained closed for a second day. As opposition to Israel's war in Gaza continued to roll through campuses across the nation, the New York Police Department announced almost 300 arrests had taken place Tuesday at Columbia and City College, just hours before Los Angeles police in riot gear swept onto UCLA's campus to break up a melee between opposing protesters. Dozens of the New York arrests involved demonstrators removed from an administration building at Columbia, where officers also removed encampments that had been the epicenter of the protests nationwide. Students and outside activists breaking Hamilton Hall doors, mistreating our public safety officers and maintenance staff, and damaging property are acts of destruction, not political speech, Columbia President Minoush Shafik said in a statement Wednesday. At City College, affiliated with Columbia University, officials requested NYPD assistance after the college said students and unaffiliated external individuals refused to leave. Protesters and police clashed at the University of Wisconsin-Madison when officers broke up an encampment there Wednesday. Video showed some protesters being pinned to the ground and apparently arrested. Tulane University said at least 14 protesters were arrested from an illegal encampment the school said was dominated by protesters unaffiliated with our community. Ohio State officials locked up some buildings in anticipation of a pro-Palestinian demonstration Wednesday afternoon. A similar protest last week led to almost 40 arrests. Surrounded by newly erected barricades, dozens gathered Wednesday at Fordham University's Leon Lowenstein Center in Manhattan to establish a protest encampment. At UCLA, video posted on social media showed counter-demonstrators battering a makeshift barricade around pro-Palestinian protesters. "The violence unfolding this evening at UCLA is absolutely abhorrent and inexcusable," Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass said in a post on X. LAPD has arrived on campus. The Los Angeles Times reported police did not intervene for more than an hour after arriving, as counter-demonstrators wearing black outfits and white masks, some armed with metal pipes and sticks, repeatedly tried to breach the perimeter of the encampment while campers pushed back and several fights broke out. The Jewish Federation Los Angeles issued a statement saying it was appalled at the violence and that it did not represent the Jewish community or our values. UCLA canceled Wednesday classes, and Chancellor Jean Block said the student conduct process has been initiated and could lead to disciplinary action. Faculty and graduate student workers rallying outside Columbia's gates wore safety vests that said "faculty," which they donned days earlier to help protect students in the encampment. "There is not a single university left in Gaza, and I bet a lot of you feel there is not a university here in Morningside Heights, Joseph Hawley, an associate professor of classics, told those gathered, referring to the school's neighborhood. But I'm here to tell you the university is here on this sidewalk. Shafiq has asked the New York Police Department to remain on campus until May 17th, after graduation. Mauna Kea, an associate professor, read a draft statement from the Columbia chapter of the American Association of University Professors, saying members unequivocally condemn President Shafiq, the Columbia Board of Trustees, and other senior administrators involved in the decision to call in the NYPD and clear the encampment of student protesters. Meanwhile, the proliferation of anti-war protests on college campuses across the U.S. is filtering down to the younger academic levels, and some of the grown-ups are not happy about it. A sit-in held Wednesday at a Chicago prep school was the latest among high school demonstrations showing support for embattled Palestinians in Gaza. On Monday, about 100 high school students in Austin, Texas, walked out of their classes in protest. Some school and government officials have tried to stop the protests, arguing they create a hostile environment for Jewish students. Two county commissioners in New Jersey demanded the school superintendent cancel a pro-Palestinian walkout at a high school in Voorhees Township. The protest was replaced by a rally for human rights. Some student activists have begun to declare victory after hammering out agreements with school administrators. The students want their schools to stop funneling endowment money to Israeli companies and other businesses that profit from the war in Gaza, and to end academic partnerships with Israel. In many cases, students also seek amnesty from disciplinary actions. Northwestern University became the first U.S. school to publicly announce a deal on Monday. On Tuesday, Brown University protesters broke camp after President Christina Paxson said the Rhode Island school will bring divestment demands to a vote.
And in more Iowa news, an Iowa man is arrested and charged in a 2021 slaying. An Iowan was arrested and charged with first-degree murder for allegedly conspiring to kill a woman's husband nearly 3 years ago. The Iowa Division of Criminal Investigations Major Crime Unit and the Tama County Sheriff's Office arrested Houston Danker, age 26, on Monday in connection with a shooting that left Ryan Cooper of Traer dead in his home in June of 2021, according to a news release. At the time of Cooper's death, there were no suspects and no one was taken into custody. Investigators at the time described the shooting as a violent death. Cooper's wife, Katrina Cooper, aged 46, was arrested for her alleged role in the death of her husband on February 19. She was charged with first-degree murder and is being held in the Tama County Jail. Karina Cooper allegedly told two witnesses that she wanted Ryan Cooper dead and could shoot him in the face, according to court documents. Further investigation showed Danker allegedly conspired with Cooper to kill her husband on June 18, 2021, according to court documents. Danker told investigators he planned and assisted Karina Cooper with the shooting death of Ryan Cooper, court documents said. The documents do not say how the suspects knew each other. Danker's preliminary hearing is May 7. He's being held in the Tama County Jail, and an investigation is ongoing.
Luther College President Ward says she'll retire at the end of 2025. Luther College President Jennifer Ward will retire next year after more than 40 years in academia, the college announced Monday. Ward, who has served as president of the Decorah University since 2019, will remain in the role until the end of June 2025, according to a news release. Ward said in the release she looks forward to working with the community over the next year at the university that enriched, challenged, and transformed her. My love for Luther is deep and genuine, and I so appreciate the challenging and collaborative work this campus community has undertaken together over the past several years to address the rapid changes in higher education and move Luther College forward as a place of faith and learning for current and future generations of students, Ward said in a message to campus. The college's Board of Regents will begin identifying next steps for the search to find a new president, Board Chair Bob Paulson said in the release. The board will update the campus community after its May meeting. On behalf of the Board of Regents, I want to express our gratitude to President Ward for her exemplary service and for putting the best interests of Luther College front and center through careful succession planning, Paulson said in the release. According to the release, during her tenure, Ward focused on making student success more holistic through a new student services department under the purview of the provost, reorganizing curriculum. I look forward to continue to engage with the broader Luther community over the next year as we advance this great college, Ward said in the release.
And you might ask, which cities saw the most rain and the biggest hail during Tuesday's storms? Well, we're here to tell you. Tuesday night brought another round of severe weather to Iowa. While it did not produce a large tornado outbreak like the storms on Friday, it did dump heavy rain and large hail on parts of the state. Here's how Tuesday night's storms panned out. First, how much rain did Iowa get? Well, Spencer saw 1.09 inches, Knoxville, 85 hundredths of an inch, Estherville, 0.67 inches, Grinnell, 0.64 inches, Des Moines, 0.16 inches, and Ankeny, 0.63 inches. And did Iowa get what's called gorilla hail? And where were the largest hail reports? Well, storm chasers, for some reason that's hard to say today, storm chasers warned about the risk of what's sometimes called gorilla hail in Iowa ahead of the storms. While the National Weather Service does not officially use that term, a meteorologist told the Register that it is often used to signify hail larger than 2 inches in diameter. At least a few reports in Iowa met the definition of gorilla hail. Here's a look at the largest hail reports from Tuesday night. Mystic saw hail that was baseball size, 2.75 inches. Malvern had 2.25 inch hail. Messina, 2 inch hail. Creston, 1.75 inch hail, that's golf ball sized. Lorimer, 175 inch hail. And in the Des Moines metro area, Ames received hail that was 1 inch in diameter. So is Des Moines behind in its average rainfall? Des Moines has seen 7.26 inches of precipitation since January 1. That's 1.35 inches behind the normal of 8.61 inches and 0.26 inches behind this time last year. Waterloo has recorded 9.20 inches since January 1, putting it at 0.94 inches ahead of its normal 8.26 inches of precipitation. Ottumwa is 3.2 inches ahead of its normal of 8.41 inches. The southern Iowa town has recorded 11.61 inches of precipitation this year.
Well, I'll turn to the 50 states and see how far we get. The highlight is Oregon, and it's accompanied by a picture of a bird who looks like a normal bird from Seaside. It says, an amateur photographer who had traveled from Washington State to Northwest Oregon to take photographs at Hug Point State Recreation Site, had inadvertently captured photo evidence of a bird so uncommon to the U.S. that some experts are baffled as to how it even got here. Experts say they are confident that the bird in the photo will soon be confirmed as a blue rock thrush. The species is native to Europe and Asia and has rarely, if ever, been spotted in North America. The photos of the apparent blue rock thrush shocked the birding world. Birders have reportedly swarmed Hug Point to try to find the bird again. He looks kind of cute. He looks like a robin. And Iowa's entry says Governor Kim Reynolds issued a disaster proclamation to an additional 8 counties due to the severe weather that occurred across Iowa on April 26th. Illinois, Peoria. A Peoria area landfill is close to full, and city and county officials are racing to find a plan for what to do when it reaches capacity. Kansas, Topeka. Gender-affirming care for transgender youths won't be banned this year after Kansas lawmakers narrowly failed to override Governor Laura Kelly's veto. And Minnesota, St. Cloud. 3-term St. Cloud City Council member Carol Lewis has launched her mayoral campaign. The 67-year-old lawyer is the second candidate to announce their mayoral run. Missouri, Springfield. In an open letter, a group of graduating seniors protested Drury University's decision to invite retired U.S. Senator Roy Blunt to speak at the May 11th commencement ceremony. They said they don't want any politician to speak. That's interesting. From Nebraska and Lincoln, an organization is seeking to repeal a new law that appropriates state funds for private school scholarships, the Lincoln Star Journal reported. And let's see, North Dakota, Bismarck. The State Game and Fish Department's 2023 Bighorn Sheep Survey found that the bighorn sheep population is rebounding in the western North Dakota grasslands and is at a record level for the fourth year, the Bismarck Tribune reported. And South Dakota, Pierre. Artificial intelligence could mean more efficient legal offices and lower bills for clients, provided human beings use the technology ethically. South Dakota Supreme Court Justice Stephen Jensen and University of South Dakota Knudsen School of Law Dean Neil Fulton offered that tentative conclusion on AI in the legal profession to members of the Sioux Falls Downtown Rotary Club, South Dakota Searchlight reported. And let's see, Wisconsin, Jefferson. 2 days after Kikkoman Foods announced a $560 million factory in Jefferson, another company says it will spend $195 million on an expansion of its production facility in the city. Nestle Purina Pet Care said its expansion will create 100 additional jobs in Jefferson, where it's been located since 1910.
And we'll call that the end of this shift. For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Linda Lundgren and me, Twyla Glenn. It's been our very great pleasure to read for you. And now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Teresa Whitaker and Dorothy Hockenberg. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Dorothy with our next article.
Okay, this is a Your Turn opinion, and it is by Ron Clower, and he is the Chief Executive Officer at Montgomery County Memorial Hospital in Red Oak, Iowa. Doctors need better access to patients' health records. Medical emergencies happen when we least expect them, but we expect first responders to arrive fast, and we expect ERs to have the information they need to make the right choices for our care. Yet it's not just delay of arrival that determines if patients get better. It's also the delay of critical information. Doctors need comprehensive health information for the patients we treat, regardless of where they receive care across Iowa. The urgency of a connected health network is critical in states with high rural populations like ours. The 2020 census puts Iowa's rural population at 37%, nearly twice the national average. In Iowa, half of our state's counties are designated healthcare professional shortage areas, HPSA, for primary care. It is even harder to access specialty care. In fact, every county in Iowa is a mental health HPSA. Compounding this issue even further is the lack of connectivity between healthcare facilities. Think of it like this. The local clinic uses one technology for keeping health records. The mental health center uses another, and the cardiologist uses yet another. None of those systems talks to each other. Your health records are puzzle pieces straight out of the box. Never mind if you are a caretaker of kids or parents or a partner. That's a 1,000-piece jigsaw. A statewide network capable of connecting to almost any health data technology, regardless of where you and your family seek care, can completely change the way Iowans receive diagnosis and treatment. Compiling all those pieces of a health record and putting them into what is called the longitudinal health record allows any doctor to have all that information at their fingertips, often in near real time. Imagine more comprehensive data, no more duplicate testing, easier communication between your doctors. Imagine not having to fill out that same medical questionnaire you have countless times before. The good news is Iowa already has a well-established statewide health information exchange, that would be HIE, called CINIC Health. It allows our community providers and patients to securely access and share medical information electronically. One study shows that the practices utilizing the right HIE can decrease emergency department visits by 13% and patient readmissions by 10%. Patient wait times are also decreased by 40 minutes. Patients save time and money. But also, there is less risk of doctors to miss critical patient data when you show up to the ER. As providers, one of the best things we can do for our patients and ourselves, besides providing high-quality health care, is connecting to Sync Health. The more health care organizations we have connected, the more robust and comprehensive data available in the HIE, and the better equipped all of us will be to help Iowans achieve their best possible health outcome.
And another opinion column is by Ingrid Jacques. Title IX rewrite hurts women, shreds justice. President Joe Biden often appears confused these days, so maybe it shouldn't come as a surprise that his major rewrite of Title IX makes it clear he has zero understanding of why the law exists. Title IX is the education civil rights law Congress passed in 1972 that demands schools receiving federal funds ban discrimination in programs and activities on the basis of sex. It's a straightforward measure that was ground-changing for women and their access to school sports. Not anymore. Since 2022, the Biden administration's Education Department has worked to respond to a record 240,000 public comments and finalize new rules that undermine the whole point of the law. I spoke with former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who spent years during the Trump administration trying to make Title IX fair for all students and to ensure that schools upheld students' constitutional rights. To put it mildly, DeVos is not pleased that Biden has erased all the positive changes she and her team made, and she argues he has introduced troublesome new ones. One thing that DeVos and others are concerned about is Biden's decision to redefine sex to include gender identity, something Congress has not done. This change will allow for transgender students to choose which bathrooms and locker rooms they want to use and which athletic teams they wish to play on. It will pose both privacy and fairness concerns for female athletes, the same young women the law was originally supposed to help. Title IX, as we know it, was passed more than 50 years ago, and its sole purpose was to give women equal opportunities, and over time, the focus of that centered around sports, DeVos told me. And with this Biden rewrite, it really does turn the tables and position the law to actually harm women by extending the definition of biological sex to include gender identity. While the Biden administration sidestepped a separate, more controversial provision that would have prohibited schools from banning transgender athletes, DeVos believes the language in the final rules will force the same outcome. Biden's rule lands at an awkward time as professional and collegiate associations tighten their rules on transgender participation in women's sports. A group of women athletes earlier this year also sued the NCAA under Title IX for forcing them to compete against transgender swimmer Leah Thomas. And a Gallup poll last year found that nearly 70% of Americans do not support transgender athletes playing on teams that match their current gender identity. So Biden's Title IX rewrite seems out of touch with what most of the country wants. The new rules also remove due process from campus sexual assault investigations and return the policy to troublesome Obama-era guidance. It's ironic that Biden wants to use a civil rights law to deny students, usually male ones, their right to a fair hearing if they've been accused of sexual misconduct. An accusation of wrongdoing should not equate to guilt. DeVos says the new policy will force colleges to go back to campus kangaroo courts, which didn't offer impartial justice and led to dozens of lawsuits, most of which the schools lost on due process grounds. That was a core piece of the rule that we put forward to really correct all of the wrongs that the Dear Colleague letter resulted in during the Obama administration, DeVos said. And this notion that we're going to go back to what they call a single investigator model, where one individual, usually someone who has a very left-leaning agenda of their own, is opening the investigations, doing the investigative work, deciding the outcome, and no one else is involved, she said. That is simply unfair and unjust, and it can't and won't stand ultimately. If you're skeptical of DeVos's take, consider that the ACLU has similar concerns, as do others. The ACLU said it opposes several aspects of these changes, including that universities are not required to provide a living hearing and an opportunity for cross-examination where serious sanctions, such as suspension or expulsion, may apply. The legal rights group is similarly concerned that schools can once again use the single investigator model, where a single person investigates a complaint and makes the decision about the outcome. These aspects of the new rules are bad enough. There are many others, too, laid out in the more than 1,500-page tome. For instance, a change expands the definition of harassment, which could mean students face disciplinary action if they use another student's wrong pronoun. And the new set of rules is written in a way that discourages schools from informing parents about what their children, even young ones, are choosing to do at school in relation to their gender identity. That's a huge blow to parental rights. These final regulations are effective in August, but numerous groups plan to challenge them in court. And DeVos is hopeful that through the Congressional Review Act, Congress could step in to rescind the changes. More than anything, though, the former education secretary wonders why Biden upended Title IX in the first place. The question is why anyone felt there was a need to change what we had done in the previous administration around this rule, DeVos said. It was working well. She said Biden is pandering to the far left fringe of the Democratic Party. And I think when it really sinks in with the American people, there's going to be a backlash, DeVos said. Let's hope so. And that again was by Ingrid Jacques, who is a columnist at USA Today.
We go now to letters to the editor. This first one is from Ellen Grimes of Des Moines. Legends Park is celebrating its centennial later this year. Its beauty may be unrivaled in central Iowa, yet its beauty is showing its age. With closed shelters and no trash removal, we are not taking care of the treasures we own. In times of budget surpluses, we are starving our state parks and not funding our Natural Resources and Recreation Trust Fund. We shouldn't have to travel to Colorado or Minnesota to enjoy the outdoors. Come on, Iowa. We can do better. Again, from Ellen Grimes of Des Moines. This next letter is from Anne Marshbanks of West Des Moines. Ban on basic income is regrettable. I wish every Iowan would read April 23's story, Which Laws Will Change, in its entirety. It would be very helpful if the Democrats' opinion about each bill would also be provided. One bill passed would provide low-income mothers a full year of Medicaid after giving birth, but Republicans also reduced the number of women who qualify. They are so tight-fisted when it comes to helping the poor. Another bill that passed actually prevents counties from helping the poor via the Uplift pilot program. The Uplift program uses no state funding. The Uplift program provides qualifying households, average income only $24,500, with a prepaid debit card with a $500 balance monthly. In past Uplift programs in other parts of the country, research found that 40% was used for food, 12% for transportation, and 27% for retail sales and services. 95% of households included children. Females comprised 85% of participants. Research has shown that basic income increased the ability to obtain full-time employment, improved physical and mental health, and provided a great ability to manage emergencies. Why in the world would Republicans want to step in and prevent counties in Iowa from providing this crucial help? Kim Reynolds should not have signed this bill into law. Again, from Anne Marshbanks of West Des Moines. And our last one is from Ivan T. Weber of West Des Moines. History is on side of protesters. As a person who protested war in the 1960s, I am bothered by how the news media have focused on the bad things some protesters are saying and doing, and have not talked about why there are students protesting. In the 1960s, we talked a lot about unjust wars. The Israeli assault on the people of Gaza is a classic unjust war. Israel's response has been not so much to destroy Hamas as to destroy the Palestinian people. This is not a proportional, a prime requirement of a just war. Israel is not threatened with destruction by Hamas. Killing 30,000 people and destroying cities and infrastructures will not destroy Hamas, which has branches across the Middle East. It does destroy the lives of people living in Gaza. Clearly not a balanced response, not a just war. But the students are talking about much more than a disproportionate response and an unjust war. This unjust war is being carried out using American weapons and American money. We and our government are not innocent, as recognized by virtually every major country, by scholars around the world. If peace is to come to Israel, it will require the creation of an actual Palestinian state, a matter which Israel opposes and is protected in this position by American policy. The students are right to oppose their government. The media are wrong to focus on these protesters who are violent or anti-Semitic. The media are wrong to ignore the mistreatment of many protesters. It would be nice to read proper coverage of the core position of the protesters. There are people in the government of my age who should recall when they were on the streets and ignored. Remembered history need not repeat itself. This is from Ivan T. Weber of West Des Moines.
Okay, now we're going to turn to the sports section, and I'll start with what's on TV today. In Major League Baseball, at 11:10 this morning, we start with Colorado at Miami on ESPN+. At 12:05 on Major League Baseball Network, we have New York Yankees at Baltimore. At 12:35, the MLBN is showing San Francisco at Boston. At 1:35, also on MLB Network, we have Washington at Texas. And then later this evening at 7:10 on MLBN, we have Cleveland at Houston. And in soccer, English Premier League, at 1:30 p.m. this afternoon on USA, we have Tottenham Hotspur at Chelsea. And now I'll go to one of the stories. Chicago Cubs pitcher Steele looks solid in rehab stint with Iowa, by Alyssa Hurdle. Justin Steele earned his first career opening day start in late March, but the Chicago Cubs slinger left the game early with a hamstring injury and hadn't played in a real game since. That was until Wednesday, when Steele, who finished fifth in the National League in Cy Young Award voting in 2023, pitched just over three innings for the Iowa Cubs against Omaha. "It was a good step in the process of building back up," Steele said. Steele allowed three runs on six hits in 3.1 innings. Omaha managed just one walk, and Steele struck out four. He threw 63 pitches, 41 of them for strikes. "The line looks worse than it is. His first inning opened with three straight singles, but a couple of those were softly hit. After easing back into the swing of things, Steele struck out the fourth batter he faced. Omaha managed four hits and two runs in the first inning alone, and Steele locked it down with two hits, one run, and one walk during the remainder of his outing. "I felt like I was a little rusty in the beginning," Steele said. "Started getting the rust off as I started throwing more pitches." This is Steele's first live game action since March, but he managed to get in some simulated games before his appearance in Des Moines. He went through an extended spring training in Arizona and did a live batting practice back with the team in Chicago. He didn't need many games. With a hamstring injury, Steele was still able to throw throughout his rehab. "It's definitely helped with the volume of throwing," Steele said. "I haven't necessarily gotten tired once during this process as far as volume of throws goes. That's definitely helped that part of the process." Other than shaking off some rust, the 28-year-old pitcher looked close to pre-injury form in some regards. His velo hovered around 88 to 89 miles per hour, which is to be expected with the amount of time off. He wasn't focused on that aspect of his pitch anyway. "I was more worried about the location of the pitch, what the pitch was doing and stuff," Steele said. "I don't even know what my average velocity was opening day, to be quite honest. But I guess it's a good thing to be around what I was on opening day." All around, Steele felt good about his stint with the Iowa Cubs. His stint in the minors might be a short one. Steele thinks he may be headed back to Chicago now that Wednesday's game is in the books. "I'm not completely sure yet. I think we're leaning toward that, but I haven't heard for sure confirmation yet." And I'll do one more here on college women's basketball. ISU hosts Oregon State transfer Hansford. And this is by Gus Martin. Iowa State women's basketball hosted a potential new addition to the Cyclones' 2024-25 roster recently. Oregon State sophomore guard transfer Lily Hansford visited ISU's campus and posted pictures in the team's uniform on her social media on Monday. It was her first visit since entering the NCAA transfer portal on April 11th. The Green Bay, Wisconsin native started only two of her 59 games played with the Beavers over the last two seasons, but developed into a three-point sniper this winter. She averaged 5.1 points and shot a staggering 44.9% from deep on 3.1 attempts per game, and increased her scoring to 6.5 points per game in the postseason. Such marksmanship could fit extremely well with Iowa State's roster, which shot a Big 12 conference best 38.3% from behind the arc in the 2023-24 season. Hansford is one of eight OSU players to enter the portal this offseason. Head coach Bill Fennelly and his staff have already secured commitments from TCU transfer Sydney Harris and Marquette guard Kenzie Hare. And I was going to see if there's any more short briefs. I do not see any, so we're going to go over to Dorothy with Dear Abby.
Okay, now we turn to Dear Abby, who says, cheating wife still calling the shots in damaged union. Dear Abby, after 10 years of being with my wife, including 8 years of marriage, I accidentally discovered she was having affairs online. She put me through weeks of lies, denial, minimizing and obfuscating before finally giving me full disclosure. At this point, I'll never know if I can believe her after 7 years of off and on cheating with one main partner and two others. Even if I were to believe she's remorseful and has changed, it's hard to live with what's already happened. It's been 15 months. I can't get past the pain of the betrayal and the feeling that she didn't love or respect me for most of our relationship. I want to leave, but finances and young children make it complicated. Also, my wife will cry, get dramatic, and makes me feel bad, telling me she will just go to a homeless shelter. I don't know if she's purposely trying to make me feel guilty or what. Please help. And that is from Living in Pain in Oregon. Abby says, Dear Living, of course your wife is trying to make you feel guilty. The best defense is a strong offense. She didn't lie to you once. Your entire marriage has been a continuous lie. Are you even sure the children are yours and not one of her lovers? Talk to a lawyer now. While you're at it, make an appointment to be tested for STDs. If you are the father of any of those children, file for full custody. Where your wife lives after that is up to her. Perhaps one of her lovers will take her in, which will spare you feelings of undeserved guilt for protecting yourself. The second is Dear Abby. I have been independent from my family for 25 years. I have always lived a few hours' drive from them. I now live an hour away from my mother and 3 hours from my sister and her family. For every occasion over these 25 years, I have always visited them, spending time, money on gas, putting thousands of miles on my car, and sometimes taking time off from work. Never has anyone visited me, other than once when my sister was passing through and wanted to have lunch. I have invited my family countless times, but there are always an excuse. Often, it's that my place is too small to accommodate them or that I have a roommate. I'm expected to spend my resources visiting them or go broke to have a place that can accommodate them. I am reminded of this lopsided situation every time my roommate's family visits multiple times per year. They stay in hotels. I'm not confrontational. I love my family, but I feel some boundaries need to be established. Am I unreasonable? If not, do you have any suggestions? From All on Me in Florida. Abby says, Dear All, if it is not practical to continue traveling to visit your relatives, stop doing it. Do not stop inviting them to visit you, however. And when you do tell them, you know that they would be more comfortable staying in a nearby hotel or motel, which is what your roommate's family has been doing for years.
Okay, and we do have time for another part of an article here from the sports section on Caitlin Clark. I don't know, I can't seem to get enough of Caitlin Clark, so we'll fit that in. Clark says 10 seconds changed her life, by Lindsay Schnell. Caitlin Clark likes to think of it as 10 seconds that changed her life. Maybe that's an exaggeration. Clark, who went number one in the WNBA draft and will start her career with the Indiana Fever on Friday when she plays in her first preseason game at Dallas, probably would have grown up to be a transcendent basketball star even if Maya Moore, the 2014 WNBA MVP, hadn't hugged her 10 years ago after a Minnesota Lynx game. Clark probably would have still rewritten the record books, earned an eight-figure shoe deal, and drawn millions of new fans to the women's game. But that 10 seconds made an impression. 10 years ago, when Caitlin was 12, her dad, Brent, drove her from their home in Des Moines, Iowa, to Minneapolis for a Lynx game. That was back when Moore, the number one pick in the 2011 draft, ruled the WNBA, leading the Lynx to 4 titles in 7 seasons, earning finals MVP honors in 2013. After the game, as fans mingled on the court, Clark ran forward and hugged Moore, her favorite player. She didn't have a camera handy, so she couldn't request a photo, but Clark didn't need proof that it happened. Ask her about it now, and she remembers it clearly. 10 seconds can go a long way in somebody's life, Clark said, smiling at the memory. That's a good lesson, whether you play sports or don't play sports, how you treat somebody matters. A decade later, there's still an obvious ripple effect from that interaction. I just try to take as much time as I can for those young girls because Maya was so nice to me when I ran up to her, and that's something that stuck with me all the way until I'm 22 years old, said Clark, who's hounded for autographs and photos everywhere she goes. She's often happy to oblige, making sure the dozens who crowd around her, kids especially, feel seen. Maya Moore says Caitlin Clark is more than stats. And it says that Caitlin Clark credits Maya Moore for the platform I can be on now. Now Caitlin will have the opportunity to be that for hundreds, thousands, millions of other kids. And it's fitting that in retirement, Moore will be able to watch and cheer from the sidelines as Clark does exactly that. And that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Teresa Whitaker, and my partner at the microphone has been Dorothy Hockenberg. Earlier, you heard Linda Lundgren and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.